Conditor al residerum aeterna lux credentium, Christe redemptor.
Is this the sound you woke up to this morning? No, me neither. It could well have been more like this. Oh, that's enough of that. Historians think that that much nicer music is the world's first alarm clock, which is 700 years old this year. If only we had stuck with it. Since then, for many people around the world, though, our whole definition of time has changed. How is that possible? Surely it's, you know, it's 9:45 or it isn't. Matthew Champion is a senior research fellow in medieval studies at the Australian Catholic University, and he's an expert in the history of time. Matthew, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Hilary.
Tell us a bit about this beautiful 700-year-old clock that plays lovely music that doesn't sound like my alarm clock.
Well, it's an astonishing survival. We have one line in a 14th century chronicle that says, at the monastery of Saint-Catherine-du-Mont in Rouen, a new clock was installed that played this hymn, Conditor Alme Siderum, Dear Creator of the Stars, on its bells. And they add a little note saying the sound was unaccustomed yet pleasing. And it's a wonderful little insight into the sense of kind of excitement about this new technology which is being developed, which is gives us a chance to play music on bells, kind of pre-recorded on the hour to announce the coming of the hour bell or the chime that would tell you what time it is in the day.
So was it an alarm clock per se, or was it a more generalised way of breaking up the day?
So this clock was probably a more generalised way of waking up the day, getting off to the start of the monastic hours. So if you think about a community of monks, they have to get up at various times in the night to sing the hours. So matins, sort of roughly 2 a.m. or lords around about 5 a.m., sort of around dawn. And for those kinds of functions, you needed to have some kind of technology to get you up and out of bed. And this is a kind of new one, the musical alarm clock. There were, of course, alarm clocks well before the 14th century, water clocks that kind of measured the flow of time through water flowing through a basin. But these new mechanical clocks that emerge in the 14th century allow for a kind of mechanisation of time and in the end lead to what's called the regular hours. So before you get mechanical time measurement, you have varying sizes of the hour through the day and the night. So 12 hours of day, 12 hours of night. But as the seasons change, obviously the hours get longer or shorter. What the mechanical weight-driven clocks allow is a kind of more regularised breakup of the hour into equal measurement systems.
Well, I imagine the monks had particular requirements for what times they wanted to be alerted to changes or prayer times, and other people might have had other requirements. How common were clocks like these or other ways of telling the time back at that point?
So these kinds of clocks you'd find in kind of elite institutions, so monasteries, large towns, royal courts. Gradually, though, and it doesn't take long, actually, these clocks get to be kind of smaller and smaller devices. So in the 15th century, you start finding a lot of images where you can see wall clocks inside domestic interiors. And in fact, some of those 15th century objects survive too. And they're sort of coming to be part of what you might call the kind of burgher elite, the kind of leaders of craft guilds who need to have time measurement devices to go off to their particular work in the morning. So maybe the leader of a cloth guild or a metal worker. And those kinds of devices are sort of the domesticization the domestication of time. That transition leads kind of through a sort of miniaturization process and a new technology, so spring-driven clocks, to watches, which you start seeing spreading more widely from the 16th century onwards.
And I imagine industrialization delivered a whole new set of requirements for how you regulated your day and how many people got to be able to tell what time it was.
That's absolutely true, though. It's interesting how much kind of common time measurement remains important in the start of industrialization. So you still need your town clock ringing the hours because that's how people are going to calibrate their personal devices. But it's very true that sort of probably, say, from around the 1870s onwards, you start getting the kind of mass production of alarm clocks, which allows shift workers en masse to go into their particular shifts at particular times. But there's a sort of continuation of that personal version of time measurement in an odd occupation that we have witnessed from the 19th century, the knocker-upper. So someone who goes around town with a long stick, maybe tapping on your window to wake you up, or there's some records of people using pea shooters to shoot pebbles at people's windows. You sort of pay a few pennies and someone would come around and get you up at the right time.
I love that idea. I love the images I saw online of older ladies, you know, traipsing around town, perhaps walking their dog at the same time with their pea shooter or their mallet or their long stick. You know, it's quite a profession.
That's right. And it's interesting, you know, that that women are involved in that profession. And they're also involved, of course, really early on in the Middle Ages in nunneries. You have similar kinds of functions. You need someone who's going to keep the time. So someone who will, you know, stay up at night, maybe turn the hourglass, maybe watch the water clock, who's able to ring that alarm to get you out of bed at the right time to say your prayers. So there's a kind of a women's history of alarm clocks too.
And when we look back into the period when those beautiful 700-year-old clocks were being built, and I was so excited to read that the mechanism was the size of a car, it's a massive thing in a tower, we sometimes think of that time as the Dark Ages, and yet there's this incredible technological innovation that's happening. What's gone wrong with our assessment of that time?
Well, that idea of the Dark Ages is something which is really kind of invented by certain kinds of people in the Renaissance who are trying to position themselves as the start of a kind of new golden age, a kind of revival of learning which has been lost. But as soon as you delve into the history of the Middle Ages, you realise that there was a lot of extremely interesting technical innovation going on. And often that was part of religious institutions. We're sort of heirs of the Enlightenment, right? We like to think that science and technology are kind of secular pursuits. But the Middle Ages teaches us that you know, there's all kinds of ways you can do science and you can get incredible innovation coming out of these monastic environments, church environments, kind of learned elites who are thinking carefully, how do the stars move? How can I measure time through the night? What are the ways in which I might do, as it were, the geometry of the circle so that I can make cogs, so that I can make the kinds of, devices which are able to harness the power of a weight and turn that into a regular motion. So those kinds of changes, which are really crucial to the kinds of time we come to inhabit now, are medieval inventions, and they're ones that my colleague in Cambridge, Seb Falk, says might like us to prompt us to change the name of the Dark Ages to the Light Ages.
I was really interested to hear too that some of those religious elites are very interested in the moral dimensions of how ordinary people use their time and when they should get up in the morning. Tell us a bit more about that.
So there's a real interest that emerges sort of in around the 14th and 15th centuries how you use your time, paying attention to time. And the idea there is that you, of course, should not be wasting your time. You should be deploying it towards some kind of common good. And in religious communities, it's pretty obvious what that's going to look like. So acts of charity, prayers and praises given to God and so on. And it's one of the things which I find kind of important about remembering this history is, you know, with our individualized, personalized iPhones with their kind of very generic sounds, it's unclear how they would prompt you to get out of bed, as it were, to do something for others, to do something towards the common good. And there's a very clear sense in the Middle Ages that paying attention to time is about paying attention to how you live with other people, how you comport yourself, how you act in a moral way. Now, I it's very easy to sort of make the counter argument that runs towards kind of a moralizing view of the world, and that certainly can be the case. But it's important to remember those ways in which we might wake up towards others, I think.
And if we look at one of the slightly different religious traditions than the ones we've been talking about now in the Christian era areas, it's you might have heard a sound a little bit like this. Tell us a little bit more, Matthew Champion, about the semantron.
Well, the semantron is an incredible musical instrument, really. It's a plank of wood which you play with mallets. And in Orthodox, in the Orthodox tradition, this is really an alternative to the bell. So I remember a few years back being in Romania and hearing this astonishing noise, a really rapid kind of drumming percussion coming from around the corner on a path. I was in a monastery and there was a nun there with her mallets, and she was absolutely a virtuoso percussionist. And what happens is, because you're sort of hitting the plank in the same places in these kind of mystical rhythms, the tones of the wood actually change, and you start getting kind of quasi melodies and interesting patterns emerging in the way the semantron is being played. It has a function, right? The function is to call the community to prayer. It also has another set of functions, that is to use the sound to purify the air, to drive away the demonic forces which might distract you or might be dangerous or might prompt you to sin. So the semantron is a kind of amazing survival, very, very old instrument that is also about kind of sounds that might startle you or kind of jolt you into a new way of thinking about time.
Well, and speaking of a new way of thinking about time, this is really where the modern world butts up against the beautiful ideas that we've been discussing, because we've got 2 minutes left. I wonder if in that time you can do justice to the idea of the eternal present and what started to replace it in our understanding of time.
Well, it's a fascinating question. And, you know, in many religious traditions, there's this idea that God kind of inhabits, you wouldn't even call it a space, a non-space, a non-time outside of our normal experience. And one of the things which these devices is aiming to do is to give you some kind of link or some way of breaking your normal experience so that you might have some kind of glimpse or intimation of what an eternal present might be like. A way of explaining it, a 15th century philosopher, Nicholas of Cusa, talks about, you know, what it might be like if you were looking at an icon where the eyes of the icon, you know, the face of God is watching you as you walk around the room. Now, then imagine someone else is in the room walking around and the eyes are following both people at the same time. So God is sort of like a still center who's always moving. And that paradox of stillness and movement gives you something about the way in which you might like to imagine the relationship of eternity to time. Eternity is not totally apart from time. It encompasses time, but it's also its own separate kind of world. And these clocks, in a way, are aiming to sort of approach something like that divine cognition, a way of measuring or mastering time, where you're able to understand it, but also stand outside it.
Whereas now we have alarm clocks that you have to chase around the room because they're on wheels in order to shut them up, and you are rarely away from a timepiece. How things have changed, Matthew Champion.
Exactly. That device I'm not sure I would like to have in my house. I don't want to chase my clock around the house.
No, I would crush it within a day. Matthew, it's just been fascinating chatting to you today. Thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
A real pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Champion is a Senior Research Fellow in Medieval Studies at Australian Catholic University. And this is Radio National.